Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.
Sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Good morning, everybody. Again, welcome to another episode of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Today, our featured guest is Gina Samarano, expert landscaping and garden stylist. If you'd like to speak with her, please call in at 347-324-3460. Again, 347-324-3460. Or you can post a question in the chat room, and we'd be more happy to read it out on the air. So, Gina, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tim. Thank you for having me.
Great. I guess to begin with, tell us about yourself, and then we can go straight into home and gardening.
Well, I am a designer based out of New York, and my specialty is creating residential outdoor living spaces, really more than landscapes, because it's my belief that the exterior of your home, those gardens, those patios, those decks, that's where we spend a good amount of our time in the good weather. And certainly it increases the living space, and it just makes for a really welcoming space that people like to spend some time in. So that's what our specialty is. Again, I live in New York, in New York Hudson Valley, and I travel pretty much throughout Europe trying to just increase my own design skills and become inspired and bring those ideas and concepts back home for my clients.
Wow. So how did you begin with this? I guess if we go full circle, I guess to begin with, during your youth, you were interested in a lot of outdoor styling, and how did this come to you?
Well, it's funny. I was always the kind of kid who wanted to rearrange the bedroom furniture. You know, I was always painting my room and rearranging. There was always kind of that gene in me. And my mom was a very talented artist, so I'm sure I got a lot of it from her. But I grew up in the city. I didn't have any outdoor spaces. When I was married and had my first child, I moved up to the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And for the first time in my life, I had a backyard. And it was hugely intimidating to me. I didn't know what to do with it. And so I started to take some classes, and that kind of parlayed itself into something I really enjoyed doing. So I joined garden clubs and took workshops and lectures. And then finally I registered with Cornell University in their Master Gardener program, and that's really the catalyst for me. That's when I said, boy, I could see myself doing this for a living.
Wow.
My background initially had been in marketing, and what I find is it's very similar in so much as it's very left brain, right brain. So the segue into design wasn't that far off. And again, it was something, design as a whole was something I had always been drawn to. So it was really for me a matter of honing the skills in the area I wanted to specialize in.
Wow. So your background, I think you mentioned at Cornell, kind of they had different classes about whole culture and landscaping, and it kind of give you the concept of how to do the designs and how to scale it, or kind of tell us about the courses themselves.
The Master Gardener course, and they vary from institution to institution, but I could tell you that the course that
mm-hmm.
Cornell hosts is a pretty intensive course, and you walk out of it knowing just how much you don't know, and that's kind of a pretty valuable thing.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty intense. And from there, I just continued the education through different design programs. There's wonderful design programs through the New York Botanical Gardens. And there's certainly, when you become kind of ensconced in this industry, it's mm-hmm. you can learn design, you can learn kind of the math behind it. But you really have to learn how to trust your eye. But that's when the horticulture comes in, because you need to know the mediums that you're working with. Otherwise, you can create things that are beautiful, but that won't work. So for landscape design specifically, it's very much a matter of form must meet function. And then to further grow it, I've over the years have taken everything from design courses to construction courses to know how to engineer the hardscape element. For many years, I was very, very busy designing custom swimming pools. And that in itself was a whole education, learning how the hydraulics work, learning the construction practices to construct a pool, because, again, at the end of the day, it has to not just look beautiful, it has to be completely uncompromised in its design so that it has the durability. These are large-scale construction projects. But what I love about the genre of design I work in is that kind of a range. I could be working on anything from, you know, a very intimate garden to a huge pool, cabana, decking, landscape that's in the hundreds of thousands. So it's a lot of fun for me to stretch it that way.
Well, so, for example, if we bring it all the way down to the basics, for the average person who would like to have a plant in a home for indoor use, do you also kind of advise your clients, hey, these are the type of plants that you might want to consider to have indoors that really doesn't require much light and they're easy to maintain? Any advice on what a person should keep in their home? Any benefits of having plants in, I guess, in the house?
Oh, absolutely. I have to say, houseplants is not my strongest suit, and I figured that out early on. So for me, my favorite indoor plant, my favorite houseplant, I buy orchids. And orchids are wonderful. They look dramatic. They are stunning in a room. They become an instant focal point. And you pretty much can't kill them with a stick. It's just, it's fabulous. There are so many people who are incredibly gifted at this and just do amazing things with them. But for most homeowners, I'll tell them, orchids are wonderful. You could go out to the store and you can buy cut flowers and have them a week or so. Or you can go to the supermarket even and pick up a spectacular orchid. It's going to last you the better part of a month. And you get all of the benefits of a houseplant as far as helping keep the air clean, and you get the wonderful kind of burst of freshness that they bring and the color and the drama. But they're so incredibly easy to grow. So I'll always steer my clients towards that. Another thing we do a lot of is container gardens. And for a lot of people, these are very meticulously cared for. When people are growing big citrus trees and big tropicals in containers, even if they don't have access, if they're not lucky enough to have a greenhouse, we'll advise clients on how they could be kind of nursed over the winter in a dormant stage to be brought back out in the spring. So we do a lot of out-of-the-box thinking with how we do it, and trying to make the most of the space. I'm also accredited as an interior designer. I belong to both ASID, which is the Group for Interior Design, and the ALSA, ASLA, which is Society of Landscape Architects. So in combining those two, what we try to do is kind of blur the line between indoors and out. So that whole concept of indoor-outdoor living that's been so popular on the West Coast, so popular, it's a way. It's not a trend in Europe, it's a way of life in Europe. And we're trying to bring that more and more into the projects that we do, too. And certainly the plants that, you know, bridge that gap are right up there in the list of what you need.
Wow. So, you know, last year across the nation, we have the scorching heat. People, grass die, the trees die. And we have one extreme to another. I guess, for example, we had real cold winters last year, blizzards nearly. And then we went to this huge heat wave for for months that really just kill plants, kill trees, killed everything pretty much. And now hopefully this year wouldn't be so bad. Taken from that, is there any tree or any plant, or what can you do in that type of situation when you have extreme heat like we had in the nation last year?
As people replacing
their trees, replacing their greenage. Go ahead.
The first thing people need to really focus in on is the appropriateness of the plant to begin with. If you have a plant, whether it be a shrub, a perennial, a tree, anything that doesn't suit the space you want to plant in, you may be able to keep it alive, but it's going to be a constant uphill battle. And the moment there is something like a very hot, dry summer or a very deep freeze winter, that plant is going to be at the top of the list of what's going to be compromised. So the first step is choose the plants that are appropriate. And a good designer is going to be well-versed in that. They're not going to put something, you know, you may fall in love with a camellia, like in the South. Well, that's terrific, but if you live in New York, that's not going to be your best choice of material. you know, there are certain things that are just not going to work here. And conversely, there are certain things that are not going to work in the hotter areas. With that said, once you have the right plant, it's a matter of protecting it and creating the best atmosphere for it you can. If you've got a tree, any tree, regardless of the weather, when something is newly planted, it requires a very rigorous watering schedule. And a tree, especially any plant, but particularly something that large, is really not going to establish for a full year. It's still going to be kind of coming to grips with its new spot for about a year. So you can't slack off on that. And drought damage specifically is very odd. People will go through a long, hot period and think, okay, the plant survived. The following season, they may see decline and they can't figure out what it is. It usually will take that long for long-term decline to show up. So some of the things people can do is certainly choose the right plant for the right space. When it's planted, make sure that what I see a lot of times, people dig the hole that's just big enough to kind of wedge that plant root ball in there. You want to go twice as deep and twice as wide and then backfill it with good soil. And that way the soil is very friable. It's not hard-packed. There's plenty of air and room for the moisture to get through. Otherwise, it's as if you were watering concrete. The water just rolls right off. You certainly, after you put in a new plant, particularly trees, you want to do a good covering of mulch. Mulch is going to keep the moisture in. It's going to help preclude weeds. And it really, all of those things collectively are going to get that material off to a good start. And starting off with good material, obviously, is going to come into play as well. And when people kind of put in the extra effort in the beginning, they're astonished by the long-term success, what a difference it'll make. So, and then as far as people in where water conservation is such a huge issue now all around the globe, there are many, many plants and many styles of landscape design and gardening that focus on xeriscaping, which is a method that is using plants that require very minimal moisture levels and relying more on hard elements and inanimate elements to create the design.
Wow. So, you know, most people will go to the local Home Depot and Lowe's or place to go pick out a plant or pick out a tree, and they're going to really be dependent on the advice of that associate to give them, hey, I know they're not, I guess they just take a training class and say, yeah, this might work. But in essence, what you're saying, you really need to get an expert and have them to come out and say, hey, this is going to work in this particular community, in this particular soil. If you want the best, especially if you're going to spend so much money on a tree, you want to try to get the best advice possible in order to make sure you're picking the right tree
or the plant for that particular soil or that particular region. Maybe it's more than the clerk will know is going to work in your particular area.
Right.
How
they're
do you
know,
pick a person?
Well, you're absolutely right, and you make an excellent point with the amount of money this costs people. And you know when, you know we all are trying to make our dollars stretch and trying to keep the budget in line. But there's a lot to be said for how costly mistakes are. So if you go through two or three trees before you finally throw up your hands in despair and say, all right, I'm going to hire somebody, you've already, you're at that point putting good money to bad. And the associates you're going to get at, you know, the big box stores are not necessarily going to be trained in this. What I suggest people do is, A, do their homework. Get online and start Googling around. And if you were to type in the phrase, you know, deer-resistant perennials for shade, you're going to get pages and pages and pages of choices that you could look into. The other thing, too, is look around the neighborhood. And if you see people in your neighborhood who seem to have, say, lilacs that are absolutely spectacular, then clearly it's probably a good plant for that area. So kind of take your cues from what you see around you. And when you're picking, which is not to say you can't go to the big stores and get a plant, but look real carefully at it. Look to make sure you see no signs of bug damage. Look to see if there's new growth. Look to see if the soil feels as if you could mold it a little bit, or is it so root bound that, you know, that plant is already kind of struggling. And if somebody wants to choose to go with a professional, again, the internet's a wonderful thing. They could pretty much landscape design as a phrase, and they're going to get a lot of choices right in their neighborhood. And most designers that I know, myself included, I get calls and inquiries on a fairly regular basis from people all over the United States, and I'll help match them up. If it's not something that would work in my business here, I could certainly help match them up to a designer and a professional in their area.
Wow. What things that a person needs to look for? Because you really, I know you have a lot of credentials, and a lot of people might be just not aware of what to look for because they just believe whatever someone says. They might just, you know, for example, put a sticker on their door and call themselves ABC Landscaping. Been in business, well, he might have been in business for 10 years, but he might just, you know, be in business maybe 5 hours a month or 2 hours a month cutting grass. What can they look for?
Yeah, that's a really good point because there's, you know, a landscaper is the guy who will come and take care of your lawn, mow your lawn, trim the hedges, do things like that. A landscape designer is an entirely different person, and there are some firms that will provide installation services, will install in my firm as well as design, but it's just being a landscaper doesn't make you a designer. So they want to look, the accreditations to look for, the ASLA, which is the American Society of Landscape Architects, the APLD, the Association of Professional Landscape Designers. Much in the same way that when interior design, you're looking for ASID, the American Society of Interior Designers, you're looking for a governing body that in order to achieve that accreditation, a certain level of education and work practice has to have been exhibited. So that's your first line of defense in picking somebody good. And then I can't stress enough, you're going to want to see, you're going to ask for pictures of work. You're going to want to ask for references. You want to see, too, because this is a design-driven project, you really need to kind of to click with the professional you choose. If you're not on the same page with that person, if you can't comfortably exchange ideas and you don't like them, it's going to be very difficult to work with them in a creative process. So you're going to look for all of those things, and you really what I say to my clients is you want to if I'm not getting you excited about this project, then it's probably not the best match. You know, it should be a pleasant experience. When you're creating an outdoor space, you're creating a landscape, whether it's something that you're not actually living in but you really love coming home to, or whether you're creating something that you're going to spend time in, it should be exciting and it should be fun. And it's very much, if you've ever moved into a new home and had so much fun kind of putting it together or built a home, it's the same kind of process where you're looking for somebody who has got an aesthetic that you like, that you're looking forward to having that imparted, easy to work with, knowledgeable, able to introduce you to concepts and products and ideas that maybe you weren't aware of. You're looking for all of those things.
Okay. As you moving into this, your brand new home, or you're in your existing home, and is there a budget range that you should start off with when you hire a professional? Say, hey, I'll just get my feet wet, but I want to get an expert to do this. I know it's going to range throughout the different regions of the country. What can they expect as a dollar amount? Say, hey, I just want to do my front yard. This person come up with $20,000. Hey, there's no way that I can afford $20,000 to do my front and backyard. What's a realistic expectation, as if they just want to get started, they want to have a nice lawn, they want to have at least a nice landscape in the front and back, what dollar amount should they actually be looking at so they won't be thinking, like, if there's someone come up to them with $20,000 and $10,000, is really just left field?
Well,
any
advice, my rule of thumb,
absolutely.
Okay. I mean, my rule of thumb is that I would never want to see, I would never support a client's decision to spend in excess of 20% of the home value on anything, including, you know, pools and spas going outside. So that budget is going to be remarkably different from a home that's $100,000 to a home that's $2 million, obviously. But that should be, you know, your cutoff point for what makes even remote sense as far as getting your money back when you sell that property. As far as what is the minimum it's going to cost you, it's impossible to say. It's more of an attitude you're looking for. If I'm working with a client and they say to me, I have an endless budget, or whether they say to me, I have a $3,000 budget, my goal is to make the biggest impact with the budget that's available. And so what you want to do is be really upfront with your designer and say, listen, I know I'm not going to be able to have everything I want at this price point, but I also want to make sure that the money I do spend is being spent wisely. So if I have this much money, what would you suggest is going to bring me the biggest return? What am I going to get for that? I will tell people all the time, you know, we're going to start with the bones of the design. It's like, again, like you're building anything else. If you're building a house, the first thing you got to do is put up the framework. And once you've got the bones of that house are in good shape, it's only going to get better. Same thing with the garden. So if I'm working with a really limited budget, I may say to somebody, you know what, let's forego, you know, the flowers and the shrubs and all of the detail pieces. Let's focus on the anchor pieces. Let's put in the stone pathway and let's put in, say, you know, the big shade tree. Let's start with that, because everything else we bring into this project is going to have to work with that. What I'll see a lot of times are when people just don't have a large budget, they'll start with little items and try to grow bigger. It's impossible to do that. It's like filling a room with a million, you know, little tables and little pillows and accessories, and then trying to find room for the sectional couch later. You have to start with the bigger pieces and then add the other elements as you can. So I'll always tell people, let's work on the bones, let's get the overall design in place, and then we can always keep adding to that. And when you do it that way, again, I would say, to really make an impact, if you're starting from scratch, if it's a new home, especially with nothing, where you just have, you know, a barren front yard, put the budget to maybe a pathway and a tree, and then you can grow it from there. But don't nickel and dime it, hoping to fill it up that way. Wait until you could get the pieces that are right. That's another mistake people will make. You know, the difference between a little sapling tree that comes in a pot that you could put in the back of your car and one that has to be delivered by a freight truck certainly is huge. But we've all seen that, too, where you've got a big home and not a lot of landscape, and you have this one sad little Charlie Brown Christmas tree in the front. It's just not going to bring the impact. So I'd rather see people get one really good piece than a lot of little ones.
And build from there. Okay.
Exactly.
We're going to take a break real quick, and then we'll take a couple of questions. And, again, we'll be back in about 30 seconds.
Great.
You're listening to The Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group. Apple Capital Group in Jacksonville, Florida, is a commercial lender that specializes in asset-based loans, equipment leasing and financing, invoice financing, commercial real estate loans, and asset-based financing in the U.S. and Canada. Apple Capital Group is a direct lender that lends on their private equity investment portfolio. 90% of most loans are decided within 2 hours, and vendor funding within 24 hours after documents are completed with a one-page application. No slow no's, just a quick decision and a fast yes. To get more information about lending from Apple Capital Group, call 866-611-7457. That's 866-611-7457 to speak with one of our loan specialists. Or visit us right now at applecapitalgroup.com. You're listening to The Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
Okay, Gina, welcome back again. The first question we have here is they're asking, hey, I bought weed at Weed Be Gone, Max or Southern Lawns, and when I sprayed it on the lawn, of course, I guess they got the advice from the clerk, it looked like it killed everything in his yard. I'm reading his notes. He said he sprayed it like instructed, and he with some of the, I guess I'm trying to say this is pretty long. Oh, some of it, I guess, got on his rose bushes and other plants, and they killed the leaves. So I guess they'll grow back. But that's one of the things that when you ask, the advice that you get from some of the clerks, and maybe this they should have did a little bit more research and read the bottle. But what can a person do really with weeds that really infest their lawn, you know, this time of the year as spring comes in?
Right. Well, here's the thing. First of all, anytime you're spraying an herbicide, it's going to catch on the wind. And, you know, woe to the rose bush that's, you know, downwind of you, because inevitably that's going to happen. And I could give them some ideas for if you have to spray, you know, get a big cardboard box and cut it out on three sides to make kind of a screen so it'll hit the cardboard and not get taken on the wind. But the best way to get your lawn weed-free is to start early in the season. You want to start a system that's applied not by spray but in granular applications of broadleaf weed preventers and fertilizers. It's not just a matter of killing the weeds. It's a matter of encouraging the grass to become stronger and more vigorous, because that will in turn help the weeds to be kept down as well. So we want to start with an application of a balanced lawn food and also a broad leaf weed killer, both of which can be applied using an applicator that kind of just rolls with you and spins it out. As far as planting beds and other planting areas, there are pre-emergent herbicides, and one of the brand names is Preen, which for somebody who is trying to keep weeds down, this is going to change their life. You sprinkle this on in the spring in your beds, and what it does is it precludes seeds from being able to germinate. So you're never pulling weeds because you're never getting them in the first place. And certainly pre-emergent herbicides are available for lawns too, but here's the thing with the lawns, and these are the questions that, you know, the guy in the big store may not ask. If you ask where the pre-emergent is, he's going to show you, and you can read the bag and learn how to put it down, but bear in mind, it's not going to let any seed germinate. They're not going to discriminate one to the next, which means if you're trying to reseed any bare areas of the lawn and you put this stuff down, you're going to be out of luck. That seed won't take. So for first line of defense is the lawn fertilizer in the spring. You want to put a broadleaf weed preventative down. That's going to take care of the dandelions and the crabgrass, those preventers. And then once your lawn is healthy and filled in, then you can start with the pre-emergent herbicides. When it gets to the point where you have to spray the weeds, you've already missed that window of keeping them back to begin with. So the idea is to be preventative and not reactive.
Okay, I follow. And what is that product again that is called that the person can use to prevent the weeds?
It's called Preen, P-R-E-E-N. And there's Preen, which is just the pre-emergent herbicide. And then there's another one called Preen and Green, which is a combination of the pre-emergent herbicide with a balanced plant food. And those for all of your planting beds, your containers, et cetera, are wonderful. And I'll even do an application of a pre-emergent herbicide when I have clients with patios that we don't want weeds coming up through the cracks, et cetera. In the early season, this will preclude those weeds from germinating, all the annual weeds.
Okay.
Anything perennial that comes up year after year, obviously you're going to have to remove by the root or kill by the root. But this will make an incredible difference to people.
Okay. Another question here says, how can I have blade grass and I have some other grass, you don't know the name of it. How can he get one consistent flow of grass in the yard? Should they pull off the blades and wish the other grass would just grow into a spot?
Well, you do it when we are completely renovating a lawn. You have to get rid of what you don't want. I mean, unfortunately, there's no other way to do it. But to make that, for most homeowners who do not want to kill off the entire lawn and reseed the entire lawn at one time, because it is a very costly, laborious process, what I will do is cordon the area off into a grid pattern. And so we will very systematically take out pieces of the one of the grass we're trying to get rid of. We'll install the new sod or seed, let that kind of establish a little bit, and move on to the next section. So whether you're cutting up the area into, you know, thirds or quarters or eighths or whatever is the size that makes sense to be able to manage it, and you systematically go through removing the old stuff, planting the new stuff. And the reason why that works too, especially if a homeowner is trying to do this on their own, it's much easier to maintain and watch over a section that you're cultivating as opposed to a huge expanse of it. But there's no quick fix, unfortunately.
Okay. I have another question here. It says, lawn maintenance companies like True Green, what is your opinion of them helping with the grass? That's all he says. So I'm assuming that he's just trying to evaluate companies like True Green who just come in and do lawn maintenance. Are they
right,
a good option to start with?
Well, here's the thing.
Not taking anything from True Green.
Not taking anything from True Green or Chem Lawn or any of the others. But my feeling is you need to look at your landscape holistically. When you start focusing just on the grass, then you're not paying attention to the trees and you're not paying attention to any other elements. And what happens is you're always kind of going in this round robin of attacking an area. If you're working with somebody who is well-versed in your landscape, including your lawn care, you're going to have a much better result.
Okay. Sorry, there's one other question here for, I think a church secretary is asking about, what are the appropriate plants to keep inside of a church?
Whenever you're talking with houseplants, you want something that's going to be maintenance-free and kind of forgiving as far as the light requirements. In most churches, they're not going to have a tremendous amount of natural sunlight. It's usually kind of dry. We want something that's really going to be easy maintenance. Fax medium is a tropical plant, and you've all seen it. It's got like the white, pointy blue leaves with the stamen in the center. That's a good choice for them. Certainly, flowering seasonal plants, the hydrangeas, azaleas, I've often seen in churches work well. Depending on what the conditions are there and what they're looking for, there's a lot of choices. But if they wanted to shoot me an email with some more information, I'd be happy to give them a list.
Great, no problem. We'll get that towards the end. I'm writing that down. Okay. The last couple of things real quick before we talk about how you got into to this as in the business sense. Any advice that you would have of a person who's looking for, which we covered earlier, any advice that you would give to the homeowner and looking for, you know, taking care of their lawn? I know it adds value to the property when you get ready to sell it. It looks good for the neighborhood, and it kind of builds from there. Is there any statistic that says, hey, by having a good landscaping design front and back and so forth, it adds this amount of value back to the house and not going to recuperate that?
Well, again, it's kind of my rule about what percentage of your home's value should be outside would certainly come into play. But as far as where the real value is, if you speak to any real estate agent, they're going to tell you that the curb appeal of any home is absolutely critical to the success of the sale of that home. So it goes beyond getting your money back, especially in this economy. I work with a lot of realtors in getting homes ready for sale, and I also work with a lot of clients who ask me to take a look at a home they may be thinking about buying to kind of evaluate it for, can we put a pool here, what would you do in the front, you know, giving them some options. What I hear from realtors more and more is that the biggest benefit of a home with great curb appeal is it sells faster. You can have three identical homes, three identical price points, and the home with the great landscape is going to be the first one to sell. So in addition to what that value is, you have to take into consideration, if your home sits on the market 30, 60, or 90 days more than it needs to, what is that costing? And if you could get it sold faster, what kind of an investment benefit is that to you? So it's in addition to what the elements themselves bring to the value, it's really the perceived value as well in how quickly that house is sold.
So the curb appeal is really, really important, you're saying?
Critical. Yeah,
critical.
It's
then versus
critical.
The backyard, that can be extra, but that first impression when they walk up into the home will kind of give them this warm, fuzzy feeling as they then and when they go into the property, it's just icing on the cake.
Exactly. And another very important point is because it's literally the first thing people see, if it is very well maintained, if it's in excellent shape, if it's beautifully designed, the perception is created that the entire house is well-maintained and well-designed and in good repair. If you have overgrown bushes and straggly lawns and, you know, chipped up walkways, it gives the perception that the whole house is going to be falling apart. So it really sets the tone for how what the buyer should expect overall. It gives an impression of a well-groomed, well-cared-for, well-maintained property.
Okay. If a person is looking to go in the career of designing, is there certain schools they should go to, community colleges or trade schools? What is your opinion if they want to take a look at that? Maybe take a novice course in it or take, hey, I'm going to use this as a profession. Can you talk about, if they want to go in this direction as a career, what they really should look for in going to a trade school?
Well, as far as college programs, Cornell certainly has one of the most premier agricultural, horticultural programs of any of the schools. They're right up there. On a local level, a lot of, here in New York, SUNY Cobleskill has an incredible horticulturally based program. University of Connecticut offers a wonderful program. There's a lot of them, and there's a huge span. There's the Rhode Island School of Design has a fabulous landscape design program, as does Pratt and some of the other design schools. But for people who are looking for certification programs, there's a lot out there for them, too. Botanical gardens, almost all of them offer something, whether it be a certificate program or a degree program. The community colleges may offer it as well. My advice to people is to really take as many opportunities in design and horticulture as you can, because there's no one course or no one degree that's going to teach you everything you need to know. It's a matter of not just training yourself so you have the knowledge of the materials, but kind of improving and training your design sense as well. So it doesn't necessarily have to be landscape design. I have had, you know, junior designers and design assistants working for me for years, and the kind of field trips I would take them on to get them thinking, we would go to fashion shows, we would go to home shows, we would go anywhere where styles and trends and color are, all of these design elements are featured, and design is a good designer can design anything from a landscape to a piece of furniture to a pair of shoes. You know, they're going to see the design value because the principles and the elements are going to be present in anything. So the idea is to really understand the principles and the elements of design and then hyper-focus it to the specialty that you want to work in. But all of those schools I named are great starting points.
Great. How did you get started with your business, your design group? Once you waited until you had all your credentials in place, or you just did it over time, how did you start opening your doors? How did you promote yourself? I mean, you had some outstanding credentials, I mean, from things mentions in CNN, New York Times. How is a small business owner like yourself got through where you are today?
Well, because design was something that was a second career for me, I kind of started gathering the education credits and gathering the certifications before I was working in the field professionally. It was more of a hobby for me. When it got to the point where I said, this is absurd, you know, I'm spending more time on this than I seem to be at my quote-unquote real job, is when I segued over and made it into a career. And for the first probably about 10 or 12 years I was doing this, I was working first as a freelance designer, working for design-build firms, and then working as a staff designer for design-build firms. And finally, the last corporate role I held in my career, I was the principal designer and stylist for a very large firm in the Northeast. At that point, after better than a decade of experience, is when I decided to venture out and open my own firm. And the big driving force for me for that was absolutely for the creative freedom it would allow me. When you're working for a design-build firm, clearly this is a business. And while I'm very fortunate to be able to earn a living doing what I love to do anyway, at the end of the day, it is business. And so with the bigger firms, you simply don't have the luxury of working on the projects you want to work on because they may not be lucrative, much in the same way that an attorney, as much as they'd like to, can't necessarily do the pro bono work that they believe in while they're trying to make partner of the firm. So that was very much a motivator for me to be able to work on the projects that inspired me. And I was fortunate that in all of those years of working with these firms, to be able to build my expertise, build my style, and to become well-known enough in the area that the success of the business was, the potential for success was much greater than it would be if I had started completely unknown or completely green. And certainly, again, from a business point of view, it's not just the design. You have to be a good business person. This is a largely seasonal field, and managing your pipeline of work, managing your materials, there is a tremendous amount of operations that goes on. If you design and build as I do, you're making sure your mason crews, your gunite crews, your this crew, that crew, plumbers, electricians, so you really have to hone those skills, learn from the best people you can learn from before you try to go out there and do it on your own. There's a lot that goes on, as with any business, the end consumer would never necessarily see.
Now,
and for that matter, a lot of designers don't see it until they try to do it on their own, and all of a sudden it's somewhat overwhelming.
How do you manage this as a seasonal? I guess you pretty much have from February to, in some cases, October. Then how do you manage all those resources after that period? Now you're just maintaining. I'm not sure what happens during the winter season, how you maintain things.
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep your, in a sense, employees or your subcontractors going, so you know you'll have them when February comes
right
back around when things start. How do you deal with that? I mean, it's
that's
just
a great question, yeah, because you want to retain your good talent. You can't
mm-hmm.
afford to, you have to hit the ground running, and you want, these are, and talent is the word. You know, when you're talking about stonemasons, you're talking about some of these specialists. They're artisans or craftsmen. You can't afford
mm-hmm.
not to have them on your team. It's kind of a two-part answer. First of all, in addition to traditional landscapes, we also do events, styling, staging, et cetera, and we design all year round. So starting in October, that kind of brings us into our holiday season where we do a lot of seasonal design for people, whether it be complete interiors, whether it be seasonal exterior work, lighting huge trees, doing the interiors, mantles, garlands, indoor trees. There's all of that work that comes in. And there's seasonal work for event staging, weddings
mm-hmm.
and parties and things like that that we work in.
Our
okay. construction will often continue until the ground is really frozen. So we have construction projects going on. We'll do the hardscape when it's colder, and obviously the softscape when it's warmer. So, you know, I had my masons and excavators going until about Thanksgiving last year. And then the design, all of the designs that we install when the weather is temperate enough for it,
mm-hmm.
are being drawn and going through the permitting process, and all of the materials are being ordered, et cetera, during the months when we're not able to get out there and actually build it, but we try to schedule schedule these things so we're doing that work in the dead of winter.
Okay. And one of the biggest things as small business owners, you always deal with this issue of bookkeeping. How do you maintain a bookkeeping and keeping all of these projects in one system? Do you use like QuickBooks or some other type of product in order to manage it, or you just have a bookkeeper that come in and occasionally or daily to help reconcile all of these different things going on?
I use a lot. I'm a big fan of the software because it too much of what a small business is going through is happening in real time. So to put it off until the bookkeeper gets there, I found is they spend too much time trying to sort through the messes I've left in my wake if I do it that way. I think it's so much easier now for a small business to manage their finances because everything is electronic, everything. Everything from payments that are coming in that are, I mean, we don't even go to the bank anymore. It's remarkable. You know, most business banking programs give you this little scanner. You just kind of feed the check through, and everything is done electronically, so there's no more paper chase. It's all right there. And working with a bookkeeper and an accountant in the beginning of the business's life helped me organize and code everything the right way once so that all the checks and all the money coming in and all the money going out were automatically going into the right accounts. Then what we do is we'll just assign a two-digit sub-number to those accounts that'll give us the ability to create and evaluate a P&L on any one project. We have it coded to that project. But the biggest, what I see a lot of, it's like anything else in life, I guess. It's always easier to do it right in the beginning than to try to fix it at the end. And if you spend the time and the money and get somebody really good to set up your system when you start, it maintains itself. The nightmare is when you've got a year's worth of statements and receipts and you're trying to make sense of it and you don't know how much you've made, how much you haven't made. So that was invaluable to me, is getting it set up properly and then just maintaining the system that was created.
Okay. And the last two questions regarding management and marketing. Since you're the main project principal manager and design and so forth, you have a team of designers. How's your particular operation and structure? You have, hey, I'm principal designer, and then we have maybe one or two people under me, and then we kind of block it off. Hey, this is the crew that come out and does the work. How do you manage all of that as being the chief designer for your company?
Well, with the design piece of it, the projects that I'm designing myself, I will often use a design assistant or a drafter to actually put on paper when necessary. When we're building, et cetera, obviously you need the drawings. For other projects, it may be talking about the concepts and then working with a designer to make sure they understand the concept, and then they would physically direct the placement with that crew that day. But this kind of goes back, too, with what you were saying about keeping your employees and your subs and everybody year-round.
Mm-hmm.
In any kind of creative field, you know, I've got people I've worked with for so long that we understand each other's shorthand and we understand each other's lingo. And you have the benefit of saying, you know, what I want to do is kind of like that curvy thing like we did in Ridgefield, and they know what you're talking about. That's really invaluable in trying to maintain the level without getting totally encompassed in the minutiae of the business. You've got to be able to delegate, and you've got to be able, though, at the same time, to regain the artistic control of it. Because when people are hiring our firm, they're hiring a certain sense of style, a certain aesthetic. And so while I encourage the creativity and the talent that the staff brings in, at the end of the day, I see everything before it goes out. And oftentimes they'll say, why don't we try it this way? And I'll say, I think that's a great idea. But it's all of the design decisions are being made with our brand, so to speak, in mind. If there's a certain look, a certain level of distinction, and if it doesn't hit that level, it's not going to go out there. So it's really cultivating. It's a slippery slope, because you want to, again, encourage the creativity and the talent and have people find themselves in their fields, while at the same time maintaining an artistic and a design direction that the clients are expecting. So it's you really got to be careful with that. And then certainly, as far as the operations go, you have to be aware of your operations, but you have to find somebody to handle them. You cannot physically do both and expect to grow your business.
Great. And how do you market yourself? Is it because of the work you've done for different clients? I mean, you've got national exposure. How did you market yourself out to pretty much the world? I mean, you have a great website.
Thank you. Well, marketing was what I originally went to school for, so I had a little bit of a leg up on that.
There you go.
And marketing and design certainly go hand in hand. I think where a lot of design businesses have not done as well as they could have is somebody could be a phenomenal designer in their genre, but they can't necessarily bring that message across on a website or in a print ad. If they're not able to do it, they need to find somebody who can, because your entire success is based on your aesthetic. So that aesthetic has to be consistent, and it has to work with what you're trying to put out there. As far as the exposure, you know what? Invest the time. Like any other small business, you never stop thinking about it. And while you're building that brand and building that name, you just absolutely explore and exploit every opportunity you can. Join every networking group you can. Go online. I've spent, you know, in the beginning of my career, I would spend hours online gleaning the name of design editors, home and garden editors, anybody who I could put a press release into their hands, anybody who I could put a letter of introduction into their hands. With marketing and with exposure, if you make it easy, and I'm sure you can attest to this, make it easy for the host, make it easy for the producer, make it easy for the journalist, the reporter, the editor. If you can give them good, solid sound bites in a well-formatted thing that they could just plunk into an article, you have a much better chance of getting exposure than if you take the approach of, I'm willing to let you interview me and question me, and then you can take my answers and produce something with them. So if I send out, you know, I'll send out a 3 or 4 paragraph article on any given topic, say holiday design, to every single appropriate media outlet I can think of, and I'll start sending those out in, you know, late September, early October, in the hope that, you know, there's going to be a segment producer, a reporter, an editor, someone who says, boy, this would be helpful. Offer yourself out.
Perfect.
As a resource and an expert.
Great. Resource and expert. Any last comments that you would like to give at the end of the show?
Well, I'd like to say it's a lot of fun for me to talk about the business of design and landscape as opposed to just the design and landscape. It's a fascinating way to approach it, because it's, again, very left brain, right brain. And when homeowners look at it that way, too, when they see not just the beauty, but where they see kind of the intelligence behind design, really cool, wonderful things can happen.
Perfect. Great. Now, how can they reach you if they have any questions? I know you have a website. If you can go ahead and tell us what the website is, and if they want to contact you directly, how they contact you.
Absolutely. The website is www.samolatodesigns.com, and that's S A M ARROTTO Designs with an S at the end .com. They can mm-hmm. also find us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page that's really active. Our toll-free number is 800-797-0598. And certainly my email, which is available just to click on the website, or information@samurailodesigns.com. I'd be more than happy to hear from them.
Great. I really appreciate you joining the program today. Thank you so very much, Gina.
Oh, Tim, it was my pleasure. I hope we get the chance to speak again.
Great. Thank you again, and have a great week.
Terrific. You too.
Same here. Take care.
Bye.
Wait. This has been another production of The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. You can download this episode on iTunes or on Blog Talk Radio Network or on blog.applecapitalgroup. Thank you for listening to the show today. Again, we had Gina Zamorado. She's the expert landscape and garden design stylist. You can go to her website at SAMAROTTODesigns.com, or you can go ahead and give her a call. She gave the contact information earlier, and that is 1-800-797-0598. 1-800-797-0598. You can reach out to her and talk to her regarding design. Really appreciate you listening to the program. Take care and have a great week.
Thank you for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For more information about equipment financing and asset-based loans, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. Or call us at 866-611-7457. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to The Core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. And thanks again for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.